Good evening. I welcome you to the fifth lecture this term of the Vancouver Institute. And we have almost 100% rollover every week, so I have to make a very strong and earnest pitch in respect of both memberships and donations. You all understand that the speakers of the quality that the Institute brings come without payment and without other than travel occasionally, so that the expense we have to undertake is to rent the space and do the publications and so on. We're entirely dependent upon both memberships and donations from the audience that comes from time to time. So I make a very strong pitch to you. Those of you, it's like church, when you go, you get lectured. And for those that are absent, to support us in either way. We look forward very much to continuing our membership growth. Now, I welcome Marjorie Ann Nichols on behalf of the Vancouver Sun to speak to you tonight, lady journalist extraordinaire, as our fifth speaker. And I was getting a little concerned, Marjorie. She was told that she had to go to Lecture Hall 2 as this place was full. She will tonight violate Father Ingham's first rule of good journalism. She's going to make a speech. And she speaks on behalf of the media. Miss Nichols, American father and Swedish mother, farmed in Red Deer, Alberta, where she was born. Actually, Miss Nichols says, like everybody else in Alberta, they spent most of the year in Arizona. Her schooling in Red Deer and her university later at the University of Montana took second place to speed skating. This was through a period of about 10 years, from 12 to 13 to 22 to 23. In this period, she worked very hard at speed skating and was three times a Canadian champion. She was selected as the first woman alternate for the Canadian women's ski team for the Squaw Valley Olympics. And this was at a time when the Canadian ski team had five men, and two women. If you wonder then about her aggression quotient when you read her column, I want you to remember this. I also learned in the course of talking to her that she trained daily during the winter outdoors. You might remember that as well. In April of 1885, this year, will mark her 20th anniversary as a working journalist.
I didn't get the joke.
Neither of us I get the joke, but anyway.
Oh,
that's 1985, isn't it? I'm so distressed about her being late, I guess. Well, she's made one application for work, and that was to the Ottawa Journal. It was the only application she made. She was hired sight unseen by a man who made one inquiry of her by telephone. Are you a Canadian farm girl? And do you have an American degree in journalism? She answered yes to both, and he said, you're hired. It turned out that he believed that this was the very best professional qualification one could have to work in Canada. It also turned out that that was exactly the qualification that he had, except that he was a Canadian farm boy. Miss Nichols agrees that it is a good combination, if only because journalism is not taught. And in the American schools of journalism, and Montana in particular, the prospective journalist is expected to take courses of substance. The object, I guess, is to put something in the head of the prospective writer. I said she started in journalism in April of 1966. Her major professional break came 18 months later when the then Parliament Hill reporter suffered a heart attack. In the best traditions of the theater, she was given the assignment temporarily and kept it. In January of 72, Stuart Keat, then the publisher of the Vancouver Sun, hired our speaker to be the bureau chief and columnist in Victoria for the Sun. Again, Father Ingham intervened. He recommended her to Stuart as being, in his words, okay. She has had, apart from her present posting in Vancouver, where she's one of the most widely read columnists in Western Canada. Other major postings, she's had 3 years in Ottawa as the bureau chief and columnist, 2 years in Washington as the correspondent for the then FP publications, and 5 years in Victoria doing what one wonders. She's recently been reassigned to Vancouver and writes her column from Vancouver. Now, I asked Miss Nichols whether or not she had any outside interests. She said none. I pressed her a bit, and I said, well, what about skating? She said, a rat ate one of my skates. So I ask you to welcome to our speaker podium tonight our speaker, Marjorie Nichols, who will give us reflections on the media.
Thank you very much, Dick. When I first met Dick Vogel, he was Alan Fotheringham's backdoor neighbor, and then he became Deputy Attorney General, and Alan Fotheringham became his backdoor neighbor, and now you see what you got, just a filthy rich lawyer. Dick mentioned my background being from Alberta. In retrospect, I think it probably was an excellent background for the trade in which I find myself now, in view of the fact that it was all of my life virtually politically neutral territory. I was born the same year that Ernest Manning became premier, and I think I was about 13 or 14 years old before I understood the difference between a coronation and an Alberta election. In fact, at our polling station where I live out in the country, it's the one-room country school where I went for 6 years. I mean, look what it did for Jack Heinrich. I don't know what it holds in store for me. The only reason that anyone ever looked at the voting results in the paper was to see whether our neighbor Bob Anderson went down and cast the one non-social credit vote. He was an Ontarian who had married into the community, and he always voted CCF. And it was that way for many years until the end of John Diefenbaker. And a strange thing happened. That election, there were two Liberal votes cast. My father is still suspicious that it was my mother. But no one has ever confessed it. In any event, I must tell you that at moments like this, there is only one thing that I really wish that I could actually do, and that would be to sing. So... But I must be on with the task. We who inhabit the institutions that compose the so-called Fourth Estate find ourselves once again at center stage in a new round of public debate about the proper role of the press. There's nothing new but nuance in all of this, of course. Since the first bearer of bad tidings was beheaded by the first despot, there's been debate about the role and or the rights of the press. 20 years ago, that has a nice ring to it, now that I can start using it. 20 years ago, when I first started in this business, the great journalistic debate was about the propriety of so-called personal journalism, the school ostensibly founded by the American journalistic gadfly Tom Wolfe. The argument then was about whether journalists should insert their personal feelings into a news story. There were those who believed, and I worked with many of them, that if a story made a reporter feel like crying, he should do his best to drip a few tears onto the copy paper along with the impersonal facts. The debate now is about what I like to call the politicization of journalism. The masterminds of the current campaign to subject journalists to a political litmus test are, for the most part, members of the political right wing. That may have more to do with the fact that conservatives are now in power throughout North America than it does with conservative theology. As Lord Acton so aptly put it, power tends to corrupt. The late Will Rogers once said that he had never met a man he couldn't like. I can't go quite that far. But I've never met a politician who, while in opposition, I couldn't like.
Uh,
It's power that changes men and their relationships, not the catechisms to which they pledge fealty. The political manipulations of the press that are being employed in this country are fortunately, I suppose, or maybe unfortunately, considerably more subtle than the truth serum tests being applied south of the border by the likes of Jesse Helms, the South Carolina conservative crusader who has now launched a campaign to buy CBS. Senator Helms and his right-wing flock allegedly want to take control of the network to stamp out its perceived left-wing bias. I say allegedly because I don't believe for one moment that the senator is to be taken seriously. I think he's far smarter than that. I think his campaign is a clever effort to further sensitize the American media, to create further self-doubt, and to promote the spread of the real evil that threatens the free press, and that is self-doubt and self-censorship. A television network controlled by a bunch of right-wing fanatics is no threat to a free society, providing, of course, that the public is aware of the self-admitted ulterior motives of the owners, which, in the case of CBS and Senator Helms, presumably would be to substitute right-wing bias for suspected left-wing taint. The real threat, to repeat again, I think, is presented when the press starts doubting itself. And I think that that is the genuine hazard facing the Canadian press today, and I think it has happened that it is happening. Monopoly control of the mass media is not as healthy as free-for-all competition, but when the press puts itself in the position of seeking to appease its political power broker critics rather than honestly reporting the news, there's always trouble. It's impossible to pinpoint the genesis of this trend toward political self-censorship in this country, but the CBC seems to be the bearer of the most obvious burden. The CBC has long been a political whipping boy, as everyone here knows, for both opposition and government. The Conservatives, during their long stay in political purgatory, seldom let a week pass without leveling an accusation about bias in the direction of the CBC. It is, after all, a crown corporation, subject to political control and therefore vulnerable. The Tories suspected that the CBC must be at least partly responsible for their repeated failures at the ballot box. Even the governing Liberals were also suspicious of the CBC. I remember back in the 70s, it was fashionable in Liberal circles in Ottawa to blame the rise of Quebec separatism on Radio-Canada, the French-speaking arm of the CBC. You bet there were a lot of separatists who worked for Radio-Canada in Quebec. It can be fairly speculated that there were probably about the same percentage of separatist voters working as journalists as there were separatist voters working for local grocery stores and haberdashers. Political paranoia about the presumed political affiliations of reporters isn't new, or even a matter of great concern. Again, it's when we ourselves start worrying about our political identity and doubting our own independent political role that I become concerned, which brings me back to the CBC. Do you think it's a coincidence that the CBC, almost alone among the bloated bureaucracies of the federal crown corporations, was hit hardest by the Tory budget-cutting acts? I don't. An independent investigator in search of federal fat wouldn't tarry too long at the CBC. We still have crown corporations they haven't even found. That's another of those non-jokes. In fact, you may remember the special investigative team appointed by Joe Clark back in 1979 to search out and identify all of the Canadian crown corporations is still hard at work. I'm told that the counters got up to about 400. They took a brief rest, and when they came back, they found about another 100. And as I say, they're still multiplying. In a private session just before Christmas, Finance Minister Michael Wilson explained why the CBC had been selected as the target of his government's much-publicized exercise in budget cutting. And I quote, "The public expected it," he said. What the minister was saying, of course, was that the Tories had to remove a pound or two of flesh from the CBC in order to make honest men of themselves. A Tory party that had spent the previous 16 years shouting in the Commons about waste and left-wing bias at the CBC couldn't just ignore the object of all that past attention. Now, I'm not worried about the continued financial viability of the CBC. It will survive nicely on the considerable remainders of its government stipend. The issue is how the CBC will react to its politically motivated hatcheting. And I think there is already growing evidence of CBC skittishness that the once fearless reporters who man the microphones at the People's Network are indulging in just a bit of self-protective self-censorship. If you listen to CBC radio or watch CBC television with any frequency, you will have noticed a growing trend. It involves hiring politicians rather than independent analysts to comment upon political events. I am not making any reference to any company here. On Peter Zosky's national radio show, they now have a once-a-week report from British Columbia. And I'm not referring to the one that Dave Barrett does, but the reporters on this show are a well-known NDP academic and a defeated social credit candidate. A coincidence? I don't hardly think so. You can see the same phenomenon nightly on the television show, The Journal. The experts upon whom The Journal relies to add depth and insight to developing news stories are, with increasing frequency, not independent experts or journalists or even elected representatives of the people. They are the new hybrid of the new age of political journalism, the non-elected, partisan, self-admittedly biased commentator. The rationalization for the introduction of these hybrids flows, ironically, from the media's self-avowed commitment to that ephemeral doctrine called fairness. When a party of the right accuses us of left-wing bias, we don't respond anymore by examining the complaint, verifying its validity or otherwise, and then seeking to correct whatever error we may have discovered. Unfortunately, I think that we've fallen into the trap of seeking to cover one bias with another. You think our columnists are too left-wing? Fine. We'll hire a right-winger and give him 20 inches of space a day wherein to proselytize. If newspaper space and television airtime weren't finite commodities, I couldn't have any objection to these developments. But space and airwaves are finite, and we have a coincidental complication here. The move toward filling our increasingly limited air and paper spaces with partisan viewpoint commentary is that it has been accompanied by the reduction of political coverage on our news pages. Once upon a time, about 7 or 8 years ago, most major daily newspapers in this country had full-time reporters covering both the federal parliament and their provincial legislatures. That is no longer the case. The Vancouver Sun, for example, no longer has a full-time reporter in Ottawa. Jamie Lamb, of course, writes an excellent daily column from Ottawa. But the routine BC news is simply no longer covered. I exaggerate only slightly in saying that a BC MP today who wanted coverage in a Vancouver newspaper for a routine speech in the House of Commons would probably have to strip and streak the chamber. We rely on Southam News Service to provide us with our news coverage of Parliament beyond the routine wire service stories. Southam is an excellent, not to mention expensive, news operation, but the news is all written of necessity from a national viewpoint. Southam can't assign a reporter to cover a speech from a BC backbencher about the problems of milfoil in Lake Okanagan. The result is that most of our new BC MPs are and will remain strangers. I suggest to you that those few who are household names got those names back when we had coverage. There's actually a bit of black humor here. a vacuum will always be filled. That's one of the laws of nature, I suppose. So these backbenchers, this situation is not unique to British Columbia. It happens everywhere across the country. The newspapers, like ourselves, that for financial reasons and other reasons, particularly because we consider that television has filled a large part of the routine void that we used to fill ourselves, as I say, that vacuum has been filled, oddly enough, by the MPs themselves. Members of Parliament in large parts of this country now report themselves to their own constituents. They do this in two ways. They give an excellent speech into the House of Commons, then they get out the Xerox machine, they Xerox 20,000 copies of it, and they mail it to their constituents using their franking privileges. And secondly, they write those increasingly sophisticated columns that you see in all of the small daily papers and weekly papers from coast to coast. The columns, of course, are not written by the MP. They are written by highly paid, publicly supported members of each of the party caucuses in Ottawa. I think the error inherent in our rush to devote more of our valuable news space to politically partisan commentary is probably obvious. There is nothing partisan about most of the news of government. So why are we so concerned about maintaining a balance of partisan bias? You know, governments up close all look pretty much the same. By hiring those with political bias to comment on issues that are not, for the most part, ideological, I think that we contribute to bias. The efficacy with which one party or another deals with the routine business of government has almost nothing to do with political ideology. It has to do with the competence of the men and women who are elected to govern. You can make the argument that some parties have more competence than others, but I think that for the most part, that's what it comes down to, the caliber of the individual who is elected by the people. I have yet to meet a politician who landed in a scandal because of his philosophy. I mean, did the fact that Bob Coates was forced to resign after a visit to a strip club have anything to do with the fact that he was a conservative? I think not. Or even Richard Hatfield and the marijuana case. That issue is partisan only in the sense that the consequences down the road could affect the standing of the Conservative Party in New Brunswick. There are members of the Social Credit Party in BC who believe that the Vancouver Sun is guilty of gross bias. Don't take my word for it. Go ask them. But then ask them what they thought of our coverage of the NDP while they were in government. The reportage of the warts of government cannot be confused with political bias, but that, I think, is the common confusion. There's only one ingredient that can guarantee honest, accurate coverage of political and governmental affairs, and that is an honest and accurate reporter. I'm frequently asked whether I have a personal political bias, and I always reply that yes, I'm a reporter. That's a flippant answer, but it's the only honest one I know. If anyone can spend 15 or 20 years covering the affairs of government and of politicians and still adhere slavishly to a particular political ideology, then I suggest that what you have is a decidedly non-normal human being. Every party and every government has bumps and lumps and blemishes. And the longer you spend around politics, the more you come to realize that philosophy simply has little to do with performance. And it is performance by which we inevitably judge governments, not philosophy. It's the character and the competence. A New Democrat who gets caught in a brothel is just as stupid as a conservative who gets caught in a brothel. The challenge of the press is simply to pursue the New Democrat and the conservative with equal tenacity. A reporter or even a columnist who announces a partisan bias or even a preference should, in my view, be disconnected from his or her video display terminal. I know there are some of you who are going to react to the statement that no good political columnist should openly advocate a partisan preference. So let me ask you a question. Who are the best journalists and columnists in this country, and what are their political preferences? Let's start with one of the best reporters in this country. I'll go so far as to say on the continent, Jack Webster. I've known Jack for, I guess, 15 or 16 years. And I'll give anyone an old brick share who can tell me how Webster votes. Or even where his partisan biases lie, if he has any. You don't know, and neither do I. Or how about Alan Fotheringham and Richard Gwynn and Jeffrey Simpson? By any test, the top political columnists in the country. I've known Gwynn and Fotheringham for close to 20 years. I know things about their private lives in exotic detail. But I don't have the foggiest notion how they vote. For that matter, I don't even know if they vote. I've heard Fotheringham accused of being a blatant conservative. That follows from the well-known fact that he's friends with the Mulroneys. The problem is, though, that I have also heard social creditors accuse him of blatant socialist bias, and I've heard a socialist call him a social creditor. I'm not talking about the good old days or pining for the return of something that can't be had again. But it seems to me that the changes in the standards that we have applied to journalism by ourselves, our standards that we apply to ourselves, has changed so dramatically. I was just thinking this afternoon, in fact, that it was only in 1969 or 1970 when a journalist, a reporter, a member of the Parliamentary Press Gallery in the House of Commons in Ottawa was considered tainted by his or her peers, and particularly by the politicians, if they happened to be married to someone who worked for one of the parties or for the government. Perfect case in point is Joyce Fairbairn, now Senator Joyce Fairbairn, who is married to a chap by the name of Mike Gillen. Joyce and Mike were both journalists. They met in the newsroom of the Ottawa Journal. It's one of our few success stories. They're still married. But Mike, who Joyce worked for FP Publications, one of our predecessors here at Southam, and Mike was a longtime reporter for the Toronto Globe and Mail. Well, eventually, Mike was offered a job as executive assistant to Edgar Benson, then the Minister of Finance. Joyce was still in the press gallery working for FP. The ink was barely dry on the questions placed on the order paper. John Diefenbaker was the leader of the crusade, and I can remember the clever little questions that he put on the order paper. He said, is there any member of the Parliamentary Press Gallery whose spouse is a political appointee of any member of the Executive Council of Canada? And the answer came back, yes. I sincerely wonder whether everyone would recognize the significance of the question if it were put on the House of Commons order paper today. There are dozens of other examples. There, Gail Scott and her husband Graham Scott, Gail Scott formerly from Canada AM on CTV. The same thing happened. One spouse stayed in the press, the other one took a partisan job, and the spouse in the press, mainly because of the pressure that the recognition that they had of themselves and their difficulties in carrying out their role, they resigned. No one was ever fired, but it was considered an absolute conflict per se. You know, if I was forced on pain of a large fine to guess about how this cream of the crop of journalists does vote. I'd have to speculate that they don't have any partisan fealties, or more importantly, any consistent voting patterns. And the reason is simple. They spend their lives looking at those politicians up close. Too close to see the partisan differences. The analogy, I think, between that old saw about the trees in the forest is quite apt. Up close, they are political trees, and you have to back way, way up to see that partisan forest. The proposition that it's difficult, if not impossible, for an honest, intelligent reporter to maintain a lasting partisan bias isn't a phenomenon that's unique to journalism. Suppose that instead of the trade of journalism, any of those gentlemen I had mentioned above had decided to become, let's say, electrical inspectors. After 34 years of watching and critiquing electricians, I think that we could expect that they would recognize the difference between good electricians and bad electricians, and more importantly, that they could be expected to blow the whistle on any electrician who performed in a shoddy manner. You know, I have never really been able to understand how it is that the job of the journalist has been so modified and so misunderstood. Political journalists are in the business of observing and reporting on politicians in general and governments in particular. To accuse a real journalist of partisanship in the line of duty is, in my view, a libel. It's like accusing a doctor of performing unnecessary surgery for profit. The sinister practice of political labeling of journalists can, I think, be traced back almost exactly 15 years to Spiro Agnew's heydays in Washington, followed immediately by Watergate. After Watergate, you may remember, journalism was one of the chosen occupations. There were little boys and little girls who wanted to grow up to be journalists, not presidents. The pendulum had made a rather erratic swing. Journalists and important journals were seen to be all-powerful. But as is always the case when the pendulum makes too wide a swing, there's a natural pull of gravity to bring it back toward more middle ground. And so the New York Times, the object of some of Mr. Agnew's most pointed purple prose about the press, hired William Safire, the man who wrote the infamous line about the nattering nabobs of negativism. It was as though the press felt a need to tell the world that it had no intention of taking advantage of its newfound swagger. But the New York Times had nothing against Republicans just because of its participation in the dethroning of Richard Nixon. And from the innocent gesture designed to appease the critics grew the present epidemic. At least half of Jimmy Carter's former aides are now political commentators or columnists or media consultants. And all of the rage on American television shows, as you doubtless have noticed, are confrontational debates between so-called journalists representing opposing partisan viewpoints. It's a contradiction in terms, in my view, to have a liberal journalist or a democratic journalist debating a conservative journalist. They ain't journalists. It's good entertainment. You know, watching the guys like George Will demolishing some poor left-winger, which is the way it usually goes. But George isn't a journalist. He's no more of a journalist than is Dalton Camp, the former Conservative Party president who writes a widely syndicated political column. These are a new breed of animal, the hybrid between journalist and politician. They're political brokers or political consultants. It's rather ironic. In the news business, we used to worry about the proper separation between columns of opinion and news stories. Everyone knows that an editorial is a piece of opinion, but when we started carrying reportorial interpretation, we were scrupulous in ensuring that it was properly labeled. Well, now we have this other kind of problem. We now have two kinds of opinion. Journalistic opinion and non-journalistic opinion of the partisan advocacy variety. You know, a priest who used his confessional to solicit information from clients that he then sold to a credit agency would be suspect. So should a journalist or anyone masquerading as a journalist who uses his access and his privileges to consistently espouse the cause of any political party. A friend of mine who's in the publishing business called me the other day, and you can appreciate I appreciated his call in view of the fact that I still didn't have a topic for my speech. And he told me, unsolicited, that he was preparing a story on what he called the crisis of confidence in journalism. I don't know whether I'd call it a crisis, but I think we have a problem. And I think our problem flows from our well-meaning but naive effort to provide what we thought was greater fairness. And from there, our decision to abandon what I call traditional reporting for repertorial commentary. The role that I perform as a commentator or critic, if you like, should be secondary, supplementary to the real role of the press, which is to report as honestly and fully as possible. I've deliberately refrained from using the word fair to describe the ultimate journalistic objective because fairness is subjective. Honesty is not. Every thinking human being, reporter or otherwise, knows whether he or she has performed as honestly as he or she knows how. One of the reasons we have been under attack, I think, is because we have started transferring more and more of our resources to acquisition of commentary, whether locally and internally written or purchased from outside the trade from those new hybrids. We have virtually abandoned the routine reportage, as I was saying earlier, of our elected representatives. In effect, we've denied the reading public the information with which to make their own judgments about the character and the performance of the politicians before asking them to also consider our views. Instead, we write columns about our MLAs and MPs, or we assign reporters to do interpretive analysis of them. That's what makes the politicians so angry. We interpret them in hideous death, but we don't report them with the same fervor. Commentary and interpretation is fine and good, providing that it is balanced by straightforward reportage. Politicians have always complained about the press. They wouldn't be abnormal if they didn't. But in the past decade or so, and now with accelerating speed, we have started responding differently to those traditional complaints. We've decided that the best way to compensate for our alleged bias of a partisan nature is to promote or hire new commentators with those different and offsetting biases. Our objective must be to rid ourselves of partisan advocacy dressed up as political comment, rather than to placate the complainers. Nor have we properly examined the illogic of many of our critics, whose reasoning goes like this. These are the critics that we have responded to in what I regard as this aberrant manner. If a reporter or a columnist criticizes, say, Socred for wasting money on ministerial travel, then the critic must be a New Democrat. Why? Because the New Democrats have been making the same criticism. The fallacy here again is probably obvious. If I agree with a Socred and disagree with a New Democrat, it doesn't make me a Socred. There are, you will appreciate, usually only two major opposing viewpoints in any given battle. I don't know how we could create some other viewpoints and hand them out so that the press could have one that was different from those that were possessed by any of the other parties. But this kind of guilt by association of idea thinking isn't just silly, I think it's insidious. But I'm afraid to say that I think that there are some of us in the press that have fallen for the trap. Let's take a recent example of alleged political bias and examine it. That, of course, would be the case of John Turner and the coverage that he received in the last federal campaign. It will come as no surprise, I'm certain, that the press treatment of Turner is this winter's most popular master's thesis topic among graduate journalism students. I think Turner did indeed receive biased and inadequate coverage. Not politically biased coverage, but coverage biased by reportorial incompetence. There is absolutely no evidence, grit suspicions to the contrary, that the press had a pro-conservative or pro-New Democrat or any other kind of a pro-partisan bias. It just doesn't work that way. You know, furthermore, it's a bit difficult logically to conclude that the great Canadian press corps, which I always thought was supposed to be left-wing, suddenly, for the purposes of an election campaign, swung dramatically to the right and became campaigners for the conservatives. I think John Turner was nothing more or less than a victim of sloppy journalism, not politically biased or partisan journalism. I think that what has happened is that some of our news reporters have started using the same license that has traditionally been available only to sports writers. They look at a political race and, like the hockey writer, proceed to call it like a lopsided game. The reporters covering Turner knew that they were covering an underdog, and they said so. They stepped out of their role as professional observers and witnesses, and they became referees and judges. I think we've created our own crisis of confidence through our failure to steel our backbones and pursue our objective, honest, thorough reporting without fear or favor. What's happened, in my view, is that we simply have allowed ourselves to be intimidated by those partisan slicksters pushing their own self-serving points of view. We started out to create that balance of bias. You know, it's rather like the case of the alcoholic who goes to the doctor complaining about shaking hands, loss of appetite, feelings of paranoia. The doctor recognizes immediately, of course, that what he's looking at is a drug addict. But being a nice guy, he doesn't subscribe to tough medicine. He whips out his prescription pad and he writes out a chit for a new drug designed to compensate for the effects of the first drug. Now we have a doubly addicted alcoholic. I think our case is very similar. The CBC, you may be interested to know, now has a new policy. I think it's only a matter of a few days old. It will not hire any former politician from now on until the expiry of a 2-year cooling-off period, the 2 years dating from the defeat of the politician or the end of the politician's tenure in whatever assembly it happens to be. I don't think the policy is retroactive, and honestly, there's nothing personal here. I was talking to someone down at Mother's headquarters in Toronto just yesterday. They refer to it there as the Iona Campanola policy. Having said that, I think that a lot of these dangers are, they're phantom for the most part. There really are real dangers lurking out there in the corridors, for the political reporter. But the dangers aren't political, they're personal. The perfect example is provided in the recent case involving New Brunswick Premier Richard Hatfield and those allegations about his drug use. Dick Hatfield probably has more close friends in the press than any other politician in the nation. I don't think I exaggerate at all in saying that. He's simply a fascinating and gregarious guy. He's a man who loves a party, loves talking about politics. Seemingly, he doesn't even need to sleep. When the shoe dropped and the marijuana charges were laid, I can assure you, there were quite a few reporters in this country whose hearts sank. The good ones knew what they had to do, and they did it. They pursued the Richard Hatfield story with the same vigor that they would have had they never met Dick or shared several gallons of brew with him. Nicholas Hills, the head of Southam News Service in Ottawa, you may have seen him. He was on television, I believe, at least twice debating the issue with Dalton Camp. I'll deal with that mismatch later. But I think that Nick Hills stands as the ultimate example of how a professional journalist must comport himself in such circumstances. It was Hills who made the decision to pursue the Hatfield story after having received a tip, a plain brown envelope, I think, about that the allegations of that other drug party involving Hatfield. Nick Hills is a very close personal friend of Richard Hatfield. Hatfield's been a house guest at the Hills home. In fact, I know for a fact that he spent a good part of 2 weeks, 2 years ago, staying with the Hills at their then home in London. He ordered the story pursued in the same manner as he would had he never laid eyes on Richard Hatfield. Now, I'm not making a pitch here for sympathy for reporters. Every occupation has its hazards, and journalism is no different. But I think that some of us in this business, as well as some of you out of the business, have been so distracted by some of these old red herrings that we sometimes fail to recognize and to congratulate good journalism when we see it. When you contrast Nick Hills and his performance to that of Dalton Camp, you have in microcosm the perfect example that demonstrates what I have been attempting to talk about. Dalton Camp, of course, has not been actively, what does that mean, involved in politics for a number of years. It's been nearly 20 years since he was president of the Conservative Party, 16 or 17, I think, since he last ran for office. He has sold his public relations firm that does all of the conservative work in Toronto and is more or less a retired country squire living in the woods of New Brunswick. He's also an excellent writer, and he writes a very good political column. It's well written, has great thoughts and ideas. He has recently been hired as a full-time and premier columnist by the country's largest newspaper, the Toronto Star. So, Dalton Camp, I think I can fairly say, was regarded by most of us in the journalistic community as having just about earned his spurs. He was one of us. And then we came to the crunch, Richard Hatfield. If you saw that debate, or if you didn't, I'll sketch it briefly. Barbara Fromm asked Nick Hills and Dalton Camp to come on and debate the Richard Hatfield case and how the press had handled it. Dalton Camp, political columnist, came on and said that he thought that people had been out to get Richard Hatfield. A journalist could have made that judgment. But then he was asked whether he had participated in the preparation of Dick Hatfield's defense. He was asked directly by Barbara Frum. She said, "Did you write the speech?" And his reply was, "If I did, I wouldn't tell you." There, what I am saying is that the difference between the real journalist and the make-believe journalist isn't fuzzy. It isn't a difference of nuance, and I'll tell you why. If Nick Hills had done or said what Dalton Camp did and said, he wouldn't have a job. No real journalist could go on TV, could tell their editor privately, or if an editor discovered that a political commentator or a reporter had been working for a politician who was in trouble with the objective in mind of saving the guy's political hide, they would be gone. Well, at the Vancouver Sun, we'd probably send the contents of their desk after them in a blacktop cab. When a reporter sees a story that he knows to be of public interest, he has an absolute obligation to chase it. Friendships, they don't count. You know, it's not really a difficult rule to live by or to understand. Most politicians simply don't get into trouble of the Richard Hatfield variety. But I guess to a lesser degree, every reporter is going to encounter the moral equivalent of the Richard Hatfield Nick Hills case. And I think that for those of us trying to establish what should or should not be the minimum standards for our trade, we should do what lawmakers and legislators do. They don't consider the minimal test to which a law will be put. They consider the ultimate test to which it will be put and then see if it stands up. I've had several of my own experiences with this, not on that scale. Otto and Adrian Lang, you may remember them. They've long been friends of mine. Our friendship cooled a little bit in the middle of Nannygate after I reported some of the detail. There have been many scandals, maybe you don't remember the details, but the Lang's British nanny, who had been worked 19 or 20 hours a day on her little stipend, was about to be returned after her tenure in Ottawa, and we discovered that the Langs were shipping her back and forth with the boys on blue on the armed forces flights back to Europe. Not a big deal, not a big scandal. But, you know, the end of that is very uplifting, that story. And I think that it probably is more representative of the consequences of simply standing up for a conviction. Not to my credit, or to any of the other journalists' credit, but to the Langs' credit. We're all friends again. The Langs still have the most wonderful parties. They've moved their parties to Winnipeg, and most of their close friends are journalists. There was never a grudge kept about any of those stories or the rest, even though they were very hurt at the time. I guess it probably sounds trite to say it, but the truth never really hurts. And if there is a friendship that can be damaged by truth, well, it wasn't a friendship to start with. Which brings me back again to those political brokers, the hybrids who are breaking out all over. Because they aren't reporters like Dalton Camp, they can't be counted on to do the right and public thing as Nick Hills did. That's what's insidious about the profusion of the brokers. When a crisis arrives and they are really needed, they can't be counted upon to meet the journalistic agenda because they have a conflicting political agenda. It's funny how this little world of Canadian journalism has changed in just the last 10 or 15 years. When I arrived on Parliament Hill, I guess it really is almost 18 years ago, Douglas Fisher was a brand new columnist for the now defunct Toronto Telegram. Fisher, as you know, was a former CCF member of Parliament, who's a librarian by occupation, for heaven's sake, whose main claim to fame was that he defeated the great C.D. Howe. Doug Fisher was regarded for many years as a possible internal threat to the integrity of the entire press gallery. It took him at least a decade to earn his spurs. I think there is now a consensus that Doug Fisher has earned the right to be considered a reporter first and a CCF politician way back there in his past. But these days, there's scarcely an eyebrow raised when a defeated political candidate leaps back and forth over that line. Conflicts of interest posed by marriage, it would be preposterous to have them considered. There's also, of course, Paul Hellyer. He's moved back and forth between politics and journalism so many times that it's hard to keep track. But I'll say one thing for Paul, and that is that he also keeps changing political parties. Therefore, canceling out and balancing most of his biases all by himself. There's another aspect, of course. I'll concede, you know, there are double standards within the press, that Paul was treated differently from Doug Fisher, not because he has been a conservative and a liberal and Fisher's a CCF or NDPer. Paul Hellyer set out to be not a politician or an economist, but an opera singer. He has a beautiful voice. Without him, the press gallery show can't go on. Just by way of late-breaking gossip, the country's newest syndicated political columnist is a defeated Liberal cabinet minister by the name of Jim Fleming. He now writes a column for the Toronto Sun. This all makes perfect logic within this new school of journalism where we live. The Sun is vehemently right-wing, so in keeping with the balancing act, balancing the bias school, it's only reasonable that Sun should offer a contract to a Liberal. What we who occupy the ink-stained trenches must do, it seems to me, is to regain our self-confidence, and in order to do that, we must reestablish the demarcation lines between politics and journalism and between criticism and advocacy. If the politicians want to advertise, let them buy an ad. For our part, as a trade-off, and I think there must be a trade-off, because you can't propose change unless everyone, or you can't propose a solution to a perceived problem unless everyone who is a party to it is willing to make some little bit of compromise. At least I'm told it operates that way in other places. I think we've got to start redirecting more of our resources toward reportage of our elected representatives. And if it comes down to economic choices, as most things seem to, then I say, fire the columnists and hire some crackerjack reporters who remember how to quote a man directly. Dr. Pat McGeer, UBC's non-deductible gift to the government of BC, I should have thought that a McGeer joke tonight wouldn't be a bad idea. I'll tell you later. Dr. McGeer frequently laments that the speeches given in the BC legislature are of a low caliber compared to what they were 5, 6, 10 years ago. Back in those days, a lot of MLAs spent their summer vacations honing their thoughts and their speeches. Those were different eras. I don't know whether I agree with McGeer about the diminished quality of the speeches, but I don't blame the MLAs if they're not putting as much effort into speechifying in the British Columbia legislature. I blame us. We quit reporting the blow-by-blow of legislative debates, and then the MLAs, I suspect, quit putting as much effort into their speech-making. We have a couple of very clear-cut choices, it seems to me. Either we back up and start reporting the straightforward facts and supplement those with a journalistic rather than a political commentary, or we're going to have to continue to live with the status quo. We complain frequently and bitterly about the sophisticated manipulators who man the outer offices of the Prime Minister. Well, again, I think there's a simple solution. If we devoted less time to running around after the manipulators who seek to focus our direction away from the issues of substance and Parliament, and return to reporting on the proceedings of Parliament, focus would shift back to those substantive issues and institutions. I've omitted only one important issue here, and that's the matter of whether news sells, now that I have advocated the wholesale return of it. I think it does. But that would be a conflict of interest for me to discuss that. And I think probably, luckily for me, my publisher couldn't make it tonight, but Frank Rutter is here, and he will be more than pleased to deal with any of these issues. We at the Vancouver Sun, as you may or may not know, adhere strictly to that most fundamental of parliamentary principles, which holds that responsibility flows from the top down. I think it's remarkable that all of you gave up a Saturday night to come out and listen to a refugee from Red Deer, Alberta. I'm overwhelmed, and I thank you very much.
Marjorie, I've got news for you. We have three other rooms full of people, and five, six, and one. So the practice we have at the Institute is that we go and visit each room and have them ask you a question, which you will hear here, and then we'll come back and take questions here.
I'm a traditionalist. I wouldn't want to break with practice, so I'm with you.
Well, I can tell you we don't usually have three full rooms.
I'll unclip you. I'll repeat the question. The Ms. Nicholson asked why reporters don't bluntly challenge the politicians when they give stupid answers to fairly obvious questions.
I suspect that you're probably making that observation based on watching things like press conferences on television, and that it is a problem. It's not repertorial stupidity involved, it's illogical logistics. What happens, and we agree on these formats, is that you have a press conference or any other kind of a session, whether it's a scrum in a corridor or a formal press conference, one man, one question is the rule. And it's very difficult because the first reporter can ask a question, did you kill him? The guy says, yes, I did. And the moderator then says, next question. And that is simply, that's a rule that has been devised in the interests of equality for all of the reporters who do the questioning. I agree with you. It's really inadequate. Occasionally, I can remember a couple of occasions when that didn't happen, when a good answer prompted the next reporter to drop his own question and follow it up. But there's a lot of ego involved in these things, too.
I think you heard me say that there were two other rooms in addition to the main room.
Well, I want to thank you very much. I'd have stayed even later last night and typed something a little better if I'd known you were all coming.
Thank you.
delicately. The question is the effect that is there news and merit in having given a national platform to the Zundel trial in Toronto?
Yeah, I think so, absolutely. It's the old question again, and it's one that we know how to deal with those issues in microcosm. I can remember. It's the old, should we cover the story about the razor blades and the Halloween apples? Do we simply cause more razor blades to be put into more apples? Yeah, I think, but on the other hand, Alec, I don't know whether... I certainly, when I saw this, saw the charges being laid and the rest, I never anticipated, nor do I think that anyone did in the press, that it would become the major national story that it has, that, that parade of witnesses and the rest. And I've heard, I was talking, in fact, to one of the producers at the CBC National in Toronto. They've become very concerned, but of course they can't simply take the story and drop it. But I think, I know, in fact, that at this very moment, all of those who have been giving this enormous display are considering what we are going to do once that trial is over. In other words, I believe that we have accrued sort of a moral obligation to provide some sort of after-the-fact balance to that. If I'd known Alec was here, I'd have been intimidated.
I'll do the same as I did in the prior room, and thank you very much for having come and explain that in the exigencies of time, we've got two other rooms to take questions from. You will hear it if you stay. I invite you to do that. Thank you very much.
Thanks for coming.
Good evening. On behalf of the Vancouver Institute and the Vancouver Sun, I welcome you and thank you very much for having come sit in here. We have, I think, the opportunity of asking at least one question. Yes, sir.
I'm wondering what your opinion or view is on the use of so many opinion polls, both by the political party and your own paper,
in the process of getting news?
As news, we still do. Quite frankly, in some cases, I argue that it's pretty unscientific.
The question is to the effect that can Ms. Nichols comment on the use of opinion polls, particularly where they don't appear to be as scientific as they might be, the telephone type poll, that kind of poll? Oh, the man on the street interview as a means of getting news.
Well, I think it's interesting that there now is a national debate in the United States about imposing some sort of restrictions on polling. You may know that we were the only jurisdiction on the continent that ever had a prohibition against polling during the election campaigns, and we laughed and rolled in the street and said, what an antique piece of junk that is. And now I think there are sort of, I think people are saying, that maybe wasn't so bad. I just think that anyone who takes a position opposed to polls is regarded as a Luddite. That's why I don't oppose it. Yeah, Jack Davis wants to know what I think of press councils. I have never liked the idea of them in theory, Jack. It's sort of like if you say to me, what do you think of censorship? I say, I don't like censorship. But I do think that it can be a useful device. But I don't know whether it accomplishes the objectives that it sets out to, whether there isn't another forum. What troubles me, of course, is that some of them have involved legislation, and I don't think that any government should legislate any vehicle that would presume to impose any kind of controls or censure on the press. Generally, I would have to say, no, I'm opposed to a press council.
Thank you very much. We'll go back to the other room and take questions there. If you stay, you'll hear them through the device. On behalf of the Institute and the Vancouver Sun, I thank you very much for having come. Thank you very much for staying. We can take questions here now. Are there any questions? Yes, sir.
I think so.
Has the emergence of monopolism in the ownership contributed to the malaise that you described in your talk?
Yeah, I think absolutely, because I think that once again, we are, rumor to the contrary, we're enormously sensitive about criticism. We may keep a stiff upper lip. We really take heed when we're criticized. That's true of the press. Generally, that's what I said about Senator Helms. I think that is the real danger in his proposal to take over CBS. But you see, and the reason I say that is that the recognition that with the closure of so many of the daily papers and the establishment of monopoly paper, the monopoly daily newspaper is now the norm, not the exception, we knew that we had to assume an extra burden that we would not did we have healthy competition. So again, I think it was out of the best of motive and the best of intention that we were so eager to, shall I say, embrace some of these new notions, because we sincerely believed that we were going to add to our balance and our fairness by doing that. But I think you're right. I think if there had been cut and thrust competition in 5 newspaper towns, I don't think that we would have stopped and thought about it. We'd have been too busy out hustling each other for the bucks in the news.
Does a radio hotliner qualify as a journalist?
They have to last for 3 contracts.
When the great day dawns and the incompetents are fired, where are you going to get the competence to be journalists?
Frank Rutter could answer that question better than I, but I would guess that even when the times weren't tough and the unemployment lines weren't long, that we have traditionally had more applications for jobs from more good people than just about any other industry that there is. I can remember the Ottawa Journal, which wasn't a very large newspaper. I know the year that I applied, and they accepted me, that they had 300 other applications from very well-qualified people that year. I don't know what our numbers are at the Sun. Maybe Frank can tell us. Thousands, I would guess.
Yes, sir.
A lot of people would like to know why it was you appeared to lose your nerve about 3 weeks prior to the last provincial election after hammering the government for 2 or 3 years up to the election when it really mattered. Marjorie Nichols really changed her views. Why?
Well, the questioner suggests that you, Ms. Nichols, lost your nerve just prior to the last provincial election. You were very hard on them up to the time of the election, and he suggests you weren't at the time of the election.
I'm glad you asked that question. There's a very easy explanation for that, and I agree with that perception. You see, I don't have my own political agenda. I don't get up in the morning and follow, you know, move the pins on my bulletin board deciding where I'm going. I play follow the leader. Where Bill Bennett goes, I follow with my little notebook. Bill Bennett was running down in one direction, and he came to a skidding stop, dug his heels in, and made a sharp turn. I went around the corner after him. That's all I did. I think that it would have been irresponsible of me after he had taken. And he said, look, halt. Let's call this whole thing off. We're going to take back 3 different bills. We're going to compromise, we're going to remove this, we're going to sit down and we're going to talk with solidarity. I think that I would have looked pretty idiotic had I continued hammering the guy, as you say, the way I was prior to that. I do not worry about my own trajectories as I go around because I don't have an agenda. I follow. And when people accuse me of, say, well, you've been, you know, you're over the map here and over there. And I mean, you know, I wasn't consistent in my proposals for a restraint. I don't have any. That's all.
Behind the bar, are there any questions?
Yes.
Explain.
You wrote a very interesting column a couple of weeks ago suggesting illicit drugs might be sold through government stores. Would you care to elaborate on that, how that would work, whether it would be limited to a certain amount of any certain individuals, how would it work?
The question's a toughie. In respect of your column on the government getting into the drug selling business, how do you see that working?
Far be it from me to propose how it should work in detail, and I concede, but I think it's a simple matter. We look at the situation that we have now and say, look, this isn't acceptable. I don't think anyone agrees. Look at the murder of the drug agent in Mexico. Does it come as a surprise to anyone tonight that the latest reports out of Mexico are that, of course, there are high officials of the Mexican government involved? When you have that kind of tantalizing millions that you're dealing with, what are you going to do about it? You know, if goodness and kindness and justice and the rest inherited the world, I know that we would all like it to be drug-free and everything to be perfect, but I don't think it comes... I believe my premise is that we simply have a society where some drugs are acceptable and other drugs are not, not for any medical reason, but for social reasons. And there is some considerable evidence, for example, that marijuana, which was in widespread use around the turn of the century, was declared illegal, and liquor was legalized because it was easier for governments to control it and to tax it. But, you know, speaking of Dr. Pat McGeer, he's the guy to ask about that, but the considerable research that's being done, I mean, what is the difference between, one drug to another drug? A drug is a drug, and following from that thinking, I say, I don't think that alcoholism is good either. I think it's a scourge upon the earth. But I don't believe that we would accomplish one thing by attempting to stamp it out. It would, number one, it could not be done. So I say, do we really want to take, we have to take the profit out of it. I think it's a marketplace decision. We're not going to get rid of it unless we get rid of the profit, because we're not going to get rid of the problem, because we're not going to get rid of the people who will always commit the crimes to make those kind of usurious profit. I think it could be done. And I think it's just the way we think. When I first said that, even to myself, I thought that's a preposterous notion. Can you imagine going down and saying, yeah, I'd like, give me 2 McEwen's beers and I'll just have a little snort of Coke? We find that offensive. But when you really stop and think about it, why not? By making it cheap enough, we can guarantee one thing. And I don't think that you violate anyone's civil rights when you say to them, look, let's have everyone go down, let's give them our thumbprint or whatever. That's one of the trade-offs. That's not a violation of rights. Make it cheap enough, and you're going to keep an absolute track of all of your addicts, number one. And number two, you're going to take the profit out of it. And number three, when you look at the estimated profits, they're incredible. We could clear away the Canadian deficit.
The questioner suggests that this Miss Nichols has wagered that there will be a provincial election soon. She wants to know how often does she collect on her bets.
Well, you see, it's not a question of collecting on the bets. It's the question of hedging your bets. Now, we always are proud of all of the predictions that we made that came true, but prediction making is about the same as at-bats in baseball. You have a very hard time hitting 300 if you're only at bat once every three games. So I try to make a prediction, three or four a week, and thereby bring up my average.
The comment relates to the headline writers rather than the reporters and the editorial writers. Suggestion is that the headline writers are the inaccurate aspect of the news. Can you comment on that?
That was the most intelligent question of the evening, sir. You are absolutely correct. Now, it's a very that's a very difficult job. And I think I should say something here. When I first got into this business, The pressure jobs were the reporters' jobs. We had, even on the small papers, we had 3, 4, 5 editions a day. And the reporter was always down at the payphone, shouting the stories into the paper. What's happened recently is that a great deal of the pressure has been taken off the reporter. The real pressure now is on the men who man those sophisticated new pieces of electronic equipment that we have. They are now performing roles that took 4 different people to perform even 10 years ago. They are virtually sitting there. They're putting it in type. They're putting the headline on it. They're doing the... And they're really, intensive jobs. I think, coming back to my theory about your batting average, I wish that I had as good a batting average as most of the headlines that have been... most of the headline writers who've been putting the heads on my stories over the years, and I really mean that.
We'll take one more question. Up in the back. That's you, yeah? I don't know if there's a privilege in this job or not, but at the risk of being sued for defamation, the questioner suggests that while there is a role for newspapers, to discharge in hiring political people as columnists, could we not do better than Les Bewley?
Boy, if I hadn't learned something in 20 years in this business, you don't answer questions like that, number one.
On that very happy note, I may say for the Institute, fortuitous, I'm going to ask Mr. Frank Rutter, the editor of the editorial page, on your behalf and the Institute's behalf, to thank our speaker. You don't have to answer the questions.
Thank you. I was just going to say the same. I don't know whether I should even open my mouth because I might not pass the Nichols litmus test. Incredible, Miss Nichols, former columnist of the Vancouver Sun. She's going to be a headline writer. No, I'm just kidding, of course. When Dick Vogel made that slip at the beginning and referred to 100 years, 120 years instead of 20 years, actually wasn't so far off because there are a lot of people in politics today, particularly, who think Miss Nichols has been around for 100 years and they wish she'd go away, but she won't. And the thing about Miss Nichols is that wherever she turns her searchlight, it illuminates and it exposes warts, everything. And tonight she happened to turn the searchlight on us, the media, that is, and I think she illuminated us. And there are no hard feelings. I'm so pleased that there was such a big turnout tonight because that's a tribute to the Institute, and we're always very happy to cooperate with the Vancouver Institute on these lectures. But it's also a tribute, if I may say so, to Miss Nichols, and a very well-deserved one, because she's certainly a jewel in our crown, and I'd like to thank her very much for this evening's fine talk.
May I add my thanks and remind you that next week we have Professor Martin Kitchen from the Department of History at Simon Fraser speaking to the topic Winston Churchill and the Soviet Union, 8:15, Saturday, a week from tonight. Good night.